We're in chapter 22 of Acts, or the last verse of chapter 21. Okay, a good chunk of text to cover today.
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of agonized a little bit over how to break this up and how to present it. So there's going to be some chunks where I'm going to read specifically, and I want you guys, when I do, to just close your eyes and listen. Because it's very much, it's just, at this point, there's less of a point or moral to the story, and it's just him telling you what happened. And it's very much just more like a story, where you're just saying, this is what's happening. And we have like an assassination attempt and a plot that gets foiled and that kind of stuff that goes on. And so when we get to those, we'll do our best. But to start with, just refresh from what we went over last week. The end of the third missionary journey, chapter 20, we'll pick up there. Paul's coming back from Troas. Shoots by. He didn't want us to go through Asia, remember? Why doesn't he want to go through Asia?
He wants to get home.
He wants to get home. For what?
Pentecost?
Pentecost. He wants to be back in Jerusalem for the day of Pentecost. But he sends for the Ephesian elders, and we went over there, his kind of farewell address to them in detail last week. Heads off back to Jerusalem. Gets to Jerusalem, and before then, he had a couple, a prophet named Agabus, who said, if you go there, they're going to bind you and turn you over to the Romans. So, you know, there's that. And everybody's like, well, maybe you shouldn't go, Paul. And Paul's like, well, no, I'm still going to go. Because I don't care if I die. I'm paraphrasing. That's essentially what he said, right? So he heads off to Jerusalem because he could be persuaded. And he gets to Jerusalem, and what's going on in Jerusalem? Who's he talk to, and what's the kind of issue that they present?
They heard that he was telling the Jews that they need to be, I don't know, something about circumcision.
Yeah, they heard that he was instructing Jews not to circumcise their kids, not to practice the Mosaic law. And that's only slightly incorrect, right? He was telling Gentiles that they don't have to start practicing the Mosaic law. And he was instructing them that the law isn't necessary anymore, that the purpose of the law had been fulfilled. The purpose of the law was to show your sin. So that's what he's been teaching. But he has not been instructing Jews not to practice the law, just to change their understanding of it, so to give a proper understanding of it. So, but they're like, we got this problem. You know, the Jews here really don't like you because they've heard that you've been, you know, dissing the law. And they think that you've gone all Gentile on them. Again, I'm paraphrasing. But
Gentile.
What? So what do they have him do to try and smooth things over?
Oh, go with those guys that ended their Nazarene vow?
Yeah.
And to pay for, basically, whatever they needed to do still?
Yeah. Go, essentially, just kind of let people see you practicing the law. Let them know that you still think it's okay for Jews to practice the traditions of Judaism as long as they understand the proper view of the law and what it's for. So he goes and he does that. While he's at the temple, some Jews from Asia see him there and they start causing a riot, right? They stir up the whole crowd. They say, "Men of Israel, help! This man is teaching everyone everywhere against the law and against his people. Moreover, he brought Greeks into the temple and defiled the holy place." So they stir him up. They bind him just exactly like Agabus said was going to happen. And there's all this commotion going on, and so they go get the tribune. Tribune comes out and sees what's going on, so he tries to get him to bring Paul into the barracks, and then Paul stops him, kind of, and says, "Could I say something to you?" Right? And the tribune says, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian man who recently stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men, assassins, out into the wilderness?" And Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And that's kind of where we left off last week. There was a hush over the crowd, and he addressed them in the Hebrew language. He addresses them in Hebrew. It gets their attention, right? These are Jews who are arresting him. So, and they're arresting him essentially because they think he's getting a little bit too Gentile-y. So, and the tribune, we're going to find out here, and we should have already realized, he doesn't really know why there's a riot going on. He doesn't really know who Paul is, why he's being arrested. And so this entire section is the tribune trying to figure out why everybody's mad at Paul. That's going to be what the theme is running through the first half of this thing. So pick up in right where Paul starts talking, chapter 22, verse 1. This is what he says, and I'm going to let you know ahead of time. What he does is essentially summarize his conversion story. He lets them know who he is, where he came from, and then tells them about what we read about in chapter 9, how he was struck on the road to Damascus, how he converted from Judaism to the way, Christianity. So this is going to be the first time when I close your eyes, imagine Paul standing there, motioning his hand for silence. There's a huge crowd of rioters who are trying to arrest him, and he's just orating his story. Okay. "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. And he said, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law and our fathers, being zealous for God, as all of you are this day. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of elders can bear witness for me. From them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed toward Damascus to take those also who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. As I was on my way and drew near to Damascus, about noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' And I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting.' Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice or the one who was speaking to me. And I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Rise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all that is appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see because of the brightness of that light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. And Ananias, a devout man according to the law, well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me, and standing by me said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that very hour I received my sight and saw him. And he said, 'The God of our fathers appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear a voice from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And now, why do you wait? Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name.' When I had returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, 'Make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Lord, they themselves know that I, in one synagogue after another, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him.' And he said to me, 'Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles.' Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices." All right. few things at the very beginning I kind of wanted to dig into. Most of that, though, you already knew, right? We saw that in chapter 9. You're just telling this story. You got to remember, these are Jews who are listening to him speak. So anytime he mentions the law, anytime he mentions things like growing up in Jerusalem, sitting at the feet of Gamaliel, he's kind of showing his credentials to say, I'm not just some crazy guy who's gone off his rocker. I have a good reason for converting. And he's very persuasive in that. But he says, I'm a Jew. I was brought up in this city. I was educated at the feet of Gamaliel. We saw Gamaliel earlier too. What do we see him doing? Y'all remember? Give you a hint. It was with Peter. And I think John.
Is he the one that if they said if this was from Christ, then let it be, because no one's going to stop God's will. But if it's not from Christ, then don't worry. People will fall away eventually and they'll figure out the truth.
Correct. Gamaliel is the guy who said, look, if this is God's doing, you're not going to be able to stop it. So quit fighting it. Yeah, that was him. He's a wise man. He's a good man. He's probably a guy of well standing in Jerusalem. So he's kind of name dropping a little bit. And he's letting them know, I persecuted the way to the death, binding them, delivering the prison, men and women. Okay. We saw him doing that. And then finally, verse 5, he says, the high priest and the whole council of elders can bear me witness. He says, everybody knows who I was. Like, this isn't news. You all knew I was condemning these people. I was taking them up,
Charlotte,
killing them.
Mom's texting me.
You got your phone back.
Oh, yeah. She's like, you're driving. You need it. I'm like, oh, okay.
That seems backwards.
I know, right?
When you think about it in that aspect, yes.
Yeah.
So, but his point is he's building up his credentials, making it clear that if he converted to the way he was persecuting, he must have had a good reason, and he's giving them a good reason. Look, the guy who they claimed to follow showed up to me and then struck me blind. So it's a pretty good reason. Tells a story. You guys know the story of his conversion. Verse 17 is kind of where we hadn't heard about this before. He gets to Jerusalem, fell into a trance, told him to make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly. I guess we did hear about that. But we didn't know about Paul's rebuttal, right? What does he say to God when God tells him to get out of Jerusalem? Verse 19. I said, Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another I imprisoned and beaten them who believe me. He essentially, we find out that when God told him, get out of Jerusalem, they're going to want to kill you, he was going, won't they believe me? Like, didn't they see my miraculous transformation? Wouldn't that be enough? And God's implicit response to that is no. Right? Obviously not. He's telling them to leave. Never mind.
Thank you.
Yeah. Verse 21. And he said to me, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. This is where they can no longer keep their peace. So, somebody else want to read verse 22 through, let's go through 29.
They listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? For this man for this man is a Roman. The commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." The commander answered, "I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money." And Paul said, "But I was actually born a citizen." Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had been put into chains.
All right. Start out with what's the statement that gets them riled up again?
Go from something to different tribes.
Yeah. Who's talking to who with that statement?
Jesus
is talking to Paul.
Jesus is talking to Paul. Jesus told Paul, "Go. I'm sending you to the Gentiles," and Paul's telling the Jews that Jesus told them this. what's their reaction?
They go nuts.
Yeah.
They throw up the dust.
Yeah. They call for his execution. Away with such a fellow from this earth. He should not be allowed to live. They want to kill him because he claims that God told him to go to the Gentiles and preach the good news. Essentially tell Gentiles that they're allowed to be saved. That's the gist of it. When Jesus and Paul both call this generation of Jews a wicked and perverse generation, they're not really exaggerating. They killed God in flesh. They're persecuting Paul. They have such... ethnic tunnel vision that they can't even perceive the idea of Gentiles being saved being an okay or good thing. It is completely reversed. The idea that Gentiles could be saved is a crime. It's something that should be deserving of death. Just kind of step back and think about it.
Do you think the Israelites in Moses' time would have had the same mindset?
I know
that's speculative, but...
I would say some of them probably would, but they shouldn't have. Because the law specifically told them.
To let them don't glean the ends of the fields.
Yeah.
Care for the strangers and the orphans.
Care for the strangers and the orphans, the sojourners in the land. They're supposed to be light to the world. Gentiles are supposed to see Israel and want what they have. And so the idea that God is saying to Paul, "Go to the Gentiles," and the Jews perceive that as a bad thing, worthy of death, is the height of irony and the depth of depravity of where this generation has gone. That it's racism, first century racism. And this is what they're dealing with within the church. This is the mindset of Jews at this time. Gentiles are dirt. So that's why so much of the New Testament is written around this controversy. A lot of the New Testament is about resolving the question of, can Gentiles be saved too? How do we deal with this? How do we bring these two people together, Jews and non-Jews? And if you read the Old Testament carefully, as Paul did after he was converted, you realize it's all over the Old Testament that the Gentiles were going to be grafted in, that salvation was going to be given to them. Some future day we should just sit down and go through some of those passages and look at it, but we'll do that later. So they get all worked up again. The Tribune says, he wants to figure out why this is all going on. He decides he's going to do it by interrogating Paul with a flogging, right? He figures Paul's not going to lie to him if he's being beaten. So they get him all stretched out, right? All ready to be whipped, and then what does Paul say?
Is it lawful for you to scourge a man as a Roman?
Yeah. You sure this is legal? I am a Roman citizen. And he says that to the centurion, right? So this is one of the soldiers that the tribune has told him, go flog this guy, right? He turns to the centurion, the guy's about to beat him, so you know, it's true, this legal centurion goes and gets the tribute. The tribune comes back and says, what are you about to do for this man as a Roman citizen? The tribune comes back and says, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Paul says, yes. The tribune answered, I bought this citizenship for a large sum. What does he mean by that phrase?
Maybe he's like, how could you do that? Because, you know, whenever I bought mine, you know, like, I paid a lot of money, and you don't look like you have enough money to do that.
All right, good thought. Saying, you know, it costs a lot to be a Roman citizen. And I would probably say that's not his intent.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Buying citizenship.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, are you really a Roman citizen? Like, I bought mine, and it cost a whole lot.
So he's more like, were you actually born here? Did you buy it?
Yeah, exactly. And I worked the system. Are you bluffing? Kind of a thing. Paul says, I'm a citizen by birth. And you don't say that unless you can prove it. You know, you go get your friends from Cilicia and say, oh yeah, there's my dad. He's a Roman citizen in good standing. Everybody in Cilicia knows him. That'd be how you do it. So he says, I'm a Roman citizen by birth. Like, yeah, I actually am a Roman citizen. What you're about to do is illegal. So, when they find out this, they withdrew. The tribune was afraid. You do not beat a Roman citizen without reason. Rome is a well-oiled machine. They are ruthless and they are brutal, but they protect their citizens until there is proof. They had quite a sophisticated legal system that you can read about from ancient Roman scribes.
It's also like a note, because it says who's a citizen and uncondemned, like, who haven't actually proven it.
Exactly.
Just don't forget that you're just doing this because you want to.
A flogging would totally be in line if you had proven it. However,
regardless if you were a citizen or not.
Yeah.
Or if you were a citizen. But, yeah, he's like,
I haven't had my trial yet, so.
Yeah. So that'd be doubly illegal, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, essentially what he's saying is, if you do this and it turns out you're wrong, Rome is going to kill you. Telling that to the tribune and the centurions, the people who were about to flog him, because that's what they would have done. If you break the rules as a rule enforcer, then you suffer the consequences. So, that's enough for them to back off. Verse 30. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused, the tribune still didn't know, right? The Jews are still all mad at him. He still doesn't know why they're all mad at him. All he knows is this guy's a Roman citizen. Desiring to know the real reason why he'd been accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. Some of you want to read 23 verses 1 through 11?
Paul, looking intently at the council, said, Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. The high priest
Ananias
commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck? But the bystander said, Do you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, and that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. But perceiving that one group were,
Sadducees,
and other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisee party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him to the barracks. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also."
All right, so the tribune brought in the council, and what happened in the council? Somebody give me a play-by-play.
Not quite sure
how to summarize it. Yeah. Start out, So, Paul starts making his defense. What does Ananias do? Yeah. Well, he tells somebody else to strike him on the mouth because he's not going to do his own dirty work. Tell somebody, hit him! So the guy hits him. What does Paul say to that?
God is going to strike you.
Yeah. Calls them a whitewashed wall. Clearly, the whitewashed wall, reference back to Jesus calling Pharisees whitewashed tombs, right? Yeah, he said, you're sitting here claiming to be a judge according to the law, and yet you're violating the law by hitting me. Some high priest you are. What do the rest of them say to that?
I shouldn't speak to the priest like that.
Yeah. Who are you to contradict the word of the high priest? Paul responds with, I didn't know he was a high priest, because if you... The insinuation is, if you were a high priest, you'd know the law, and you would know that the law says you shall not speak evil against the ruler of your people. Jesus is who he's referring to, I think. There's this kind of question, though, is Paul earnestly repenting in that verse? Verse 5, I did not know, brothers, he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil.
Sarcasm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read it as he was covering his basis and respecting authority.
Okay, so that's, and those are kind of the two. Is he kind of respectfully saying, yeah, I apologize, I didn't know he was the high priest, and since I'm supposed to be, I shall not speak evil against the ruler of my people, I should not have said that kind of a thing? Or is he kind of sassing him, taunting him, saying, he doesn't have the right to be a high priest because he's not acting in accordance with the law?
A little bit of both, you know. Oh, really? But if that's the case, then I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. I gave you a quote from John Calvin on that. He takes the sass approach. I do not doubt that this is a taunting excuse. Paul purges himself of the crime, yet so that he denies that Ananias is to be counted a priest of God who has corrupted and perverted all the order of the church.
So,
a little bit of both. Who all is here in this council? Particularly, we know at least one guy by name and two other groups of people. The guy by name, Ananias, high priest. Who are the other two groups?
The Sadducees and the Pharisees.
Sadducees and the Pharisees. Okay. Give me a quick rundown of what the Sadducees believe in opposition to the Pharisees, what he told you here.
Sadducees. Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit.
Correct.
The Pharisees acknowledge them all.
Yeah. The Pharisees, this isn't a perfect analogy, but good enough for government work. Pharisees are the first century ultra-conservatives, legalists. They know the law inside and out. They affirm all of the books of the Old Testament. They believe all of the right things, hold all of the right doctrines, and want to try and follow them as much as possible. The Sadducees are kind of like the first century liberals. They take, sure, the first five books of the Old Testament. They don't really put a whole lot of stock into much of the prophets or the other writings. They don't really think there's a resurrection of the dead. They don't think much of the spiritual life. They're kind of like Jews by name. And they're more interested in political power and weaseling their way up the ladder than correct doctrine. So these guys, Sadducees and Pharisees, are in complete opposite ends of the spectrum in the first century. Theology, which is part of what makes the fact that they team up so often in the Gospels and in the Acts kind of ironic, because they never would have in other circumstances. The point is, they're both missing the truth. They both don't have, they don't recognize God in flesh.
But
Paul,
it's a common enemy, I guess.
Exactly.
Paul and Jesus.
And that's what it really is. It's this common enemy unites
friend.
Them.
And what is it? Enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah. But Paul sees that there's both Sadducees and Pharisees in this council. So,
how do you make them both mad?
Yeah. How do you make them both mad? What he does is he brings up the main point of contention between the two theologically.
Resurrection.
Yeah. Resurrection. All I've been doing is saying that there is a resurrection of the dead. Pharisees, you agree with me, right? And all the Pharisees are going, yeah, we agree with you on that. There definitely is. And the Sadducees are going, what are you talking about? So essentially, he uses this one little one-liner to...
all
right, fight! I'll see you later.
Kind of walk out of here while you...
Yeah.
Talk amongst yourself.
I imagine just this big cloud of dust and stuff as they're brawling, and then Paul just walks out.
Right? Like in, like, Looney Tunes, we saw seeing, like, bats and, like, chainsaws.
Yeah.
Like, where did that come from?
Yeah. But anyway, he gets them to essentially get off track by stating a true fact about himself. I'm a Pharisee, and I'm the reason you have me here is because I'm preaching the resurrection of the dead. That's all I've been preaching. That's the gospel. The Pharisees stand up. A couple of the Pharisee scribes stand up, and they say, we don't find anything wrong with him. What if he's telling the truth? Kind of along the lines of what Gamaliel said. What if what he said is correct? What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? The dissension becomes violent, and so the Romans step in, shut it down. The tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down, take him away from among them by force, and bring him back into the barracks. So, obviously, the tribune's attempt to figure out why they're so mad at Paul in this instance, again, failed. Maybe if I bring this council together, I'll find out why they're so mad at him. No such luck. Brings him back to the barracks, still hasn't figured out exactly why they're pissed off at Paul. That night, what does Paul receive from the Lord?
It says the Mike says the Lord stood by his side.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Because he already has the Holy Spirit.
Good catch.
Physical manifestation next
to. Yeah, this is one that kind of slips under the radar. Lots of people will talk about Stephen seeing Jesus standing at God's right hand, but verse 11 of chapter 23, yeah. Supposedly, and I would say the Lord there is a reference to Jesus, second person of the Trinity.
People write books about, would you rather have the Lord by your side or the Holy Spirit inside? I mean, they're like books are actually there.
Is it a physical standing by? It's not like a metaphor like, oh, I'm standing beside you on this issue.
I think it's physical. I think it's Jesus
shut up.
Takes physical form there.
Yeah.
I definitely wouldn't start a new church over it.
Or leave.
I would write a book about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
but what does the Lord say to him?
Take courage.
Yeah.
For you will testify to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.
Yeah. Got to get you to Rome. So.
It's also like confirmation that he's going to get out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, not for a great reason, but...
Yeah. You got to go to Rome and do this all over again. And then they're going to kill you.
They're not done yet.
But it's reassuring to Paul. This next section I'm going to read again. So go ahead and close your eyes again. Imagine Paul sitting in prison at night, the Lord standing by him. The tribune is worrying in his office. A huge pile of papers that he needs to shred. The Jews are still mad at him. They're brawling. Okay. Verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy, and they went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we're ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister, Paul's nephew, heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took the young man and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you." Tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him, but do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one what you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen. Go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night." That's 9 p.m. "Also, provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to his excellency the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man. I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul, brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go with him. They come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor. They presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. All right. So, can you summarize that little story for me? What happened?
There were some Jews that wanted to kill Paul and decided to not eat until they did so. But Paul was already going to Rome.
Yeah, Paul's in prison.
Huh.
His nephew learns about it.
And he's like, "I'm going to go rat them out."
Yeah, "I'm going to go rat them out." So he does. And then the tribune, when he does, what's he do?
Gets 200 soldiers.
Yeah. Gets a huge group of guards to keep Paul safe and take him to Caesarea by the sea.
Thank
you. So, wanted to show you some pictures of Caesarea by the sea. You can go there today. I've been there. You can actually stand in the very building, probably in the very room, where Paul made his defense. So this is a map. I know it's tiny. Oop. So he's going from Jerusalem, and they're walking across to Caesarea up here. Jerusalem, Caesarea, he goes with armed guards, 200 soldiers, right? There to there.
How far is that?
It's like 3 inches.
Okay.
Bro.
I'm going to have to guess. I think it's about 15, 20 miles.
Okay.
Not super far, a good full day's walk. And then there's pictures. So this is Caesarea by the Sea. This is a good aerial kind of the palace that Herod the Great, the one who he built a whole lot of things all over Israel. He built this huge palace with a hippodrome, horse racing place, a theater, and a palace with like a bath right here on the ocean. And the remains of it are still there. So you can go there and see. And this is Herod's Praetorium. So this is where Paul's being kept. And when you go there, you're standing, you've got the Mediterranean Sea on one side, and you've got these big open fields on the other, and then you can see these hills in the distance. You're standing there on the palace walls, and you essentially, they tell you, look over at those hills and just imagine 200 guards walking over over those hills, headed for here. Guarding Paul, keeping Paul safe. And they come and they go in here and And where are my photos? These are the photos I took when I was there. So that's the building out there on the side of the ocean.
It's pretty.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The water's so blue in the Mediterranean.
Wow.
The hippodrome is back there in the background, and the theater is over here. That's the building, or the remains of it. And that's the bath at the edge of the building. This is what I wanted to get to. This is the room where Paul was. You can actually go there and stand there.
There's no wall.
Yeah.
It's not a room.
And you can see the base of where the walls were, right there. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool when you're there. But he gets there. Felix receives the letter and says, I'll give you a hearing tomorrow. So, we're going to go over chapter 24 and hear Paul's accusation and defense. So, I'm going to wait for your accusers to get here because the letter says they're coming, right? So, High Priest Ananias, a couple elders, and a rhetorician, Tertullus, comes down to essentially present the case against Paul.
That says attorney.
Attorney?
Mm-hmm.
Spokesman. The word is rhetoros.
Bethany knows.
Tertullus is a slime ball. Felix is kind of a slime ball too. Felix, the governor that they're presenting their case before, Felix is he's a former slave who won his freedom and then kind of worked the system to raise the ranks. Tacitus, an ancient historian, says that Felix exercised royal power with the mind of a slave. He's brutal and known for his violent self-advancement. His character. So, after 5 days, chapter 24, verse 1, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he'd been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, right, so this is Tertullus's accusation against Paul on behalf of the Jews. Right? This, so we finally get the answer the tribune's been looking for. Why are you up in arms about this guy, Paul? And this is the answer. This is their case. Verse 2. Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, Since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming all the things that, saying that they were so. So, first of all, he spends more time flattering Felix than he does actually making the charges. He's a rhetorician, and the Greek all throughout this passage is like, and you got your dictionary out, looking at every other word. It's crazy. But what are the charges that he levels against Paul? Three main charges. What are they?
He's a pest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a ringleader.
It makes him sound like he's a cult leader.
Yeah, the sect of the Nazarenes. Mm-hmm. Remember Jesus of Nazareth. So, getting the feeling. Jews view the way here as a sect, a cult, like you said. And
he profanes the temple.
Yeah, he tried to profane the temple, according to... It's the same thing that way back in chapter 21, when they were stirring up the riot to begin with, that got him arrested. That's what the Jews in Asia were saying, right? They were saying, this man is teaching everyone against the law, and he even brought Greeks into the temple and defiled it, which wasn't true. So it's kind of the same, they're running the same party line here. Quick note, is there a verse 7 or isn't there? Verse 7 isn't in some of the best manuscripts that we have, and so verse 7 might say, but the chief captain of Lycia came and with a great violence took him out of our hands. This is part of Tertullus' thing, mm-hmm. saying, the tribune stopped us before we could execute our own justice. Essentially what he's saying is, we tried to try him in our courts, but the Romans got in the way before we could. And so, we're sorry that it had to be brought to you, Felix. We tried to deal with this ourselves internally. This is a Jewish matter, not for you Romans to get into.
Oh, referring to that fake story they were going to give the Tribune about when
we
talk to him some more about it?
Yeah.
That actually we're
going to
kill him?
Yes.
So Felix is
from... Yeah, so Felix is a governor. We haven't seen him yet. He's the new guy. He's the tribune, Lysias, sent him off to Felix in Caesarea. Said, Felix.
Caesarea is not near Rome.
Okay, well, Rome, when I say Rome, I'm talking about national Rome.
All that Rome.
The empire.
Yeah.
So he's there to keep peace.
Rome is a city, but it's also an empire. Okay. So,
he's there to keep the peace.
Wait, so in that, like, verse 7 thing, it says, you know, like, at the beginning, they, like, we would have judged him according to our law, would that assume that he's also a Jew?
Yeah.
Because it says that. Okay.
Yeah.
He's the Jew's lawyer.
Mm.
And Paul's his own representative.
He's pro se.
Are you still...
No.
No, you're not understanding, or no, you're...
No, I'm not confused.
Okay. Okay. And if... Don't... Be afraid to say if you are. It's a confusing thing. But yeah, Rome as an empire controls most of the Middle East at this point.
Okay.
So, Caesarea is one of their main outposts. Okay. Like, they'll send envoys there to port city. So they come in, and that's one of their lead cities to kind of govern the Palestine area. So Felix is a governor. He's there. He's acting on behalf of the Roman Senate. So he's hearing the case. So Tertullus levels these charges against him, and he says, he finishes up with, by examining him yourself, you will find that everything that we said about him is true. And the Jews all say, hear, hear. When the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied. So this is what he says in his own defense. Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I was up to worship in Jerusalem. They did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in this city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me, but this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purifying in the temple without any crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you. to make an accusation, should they have anything against me. Or else, let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you this day. So essentially, what he says, they can't prove any of this. The only reason I'm here is because I claim that there's a resurrection from the dead, which they agree with. They got no reason to be accusing me. And you can find out for yourself. There's no proof. That's essentially what he says. Everybody follow that? Anything we need to dig into there?
Well, I guess, just want to confirm it. By that, Paul is saying that these are only Pharisees that are here at the moment. Ananias and stuff. Because if he's saying they agree with me about the resurrection and stuff, where is that? Or are they both there?
I would say probably we're just dealing with Pharisees at this point. We don't know if Ananias was a Pharisee or not. So, we know very little about this particular high priest Ananias. So yeah, I would say since he said that they agree with me that there's a resurrection. Probably just Pharisees who came down to accuse him. I kind of gave you a point by point summary of Paul's reply, so what does Felix do? Somebody want to read 22 through 27?
But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, "When Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case." Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody, but have some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you." At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. So he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison.
Sounds like the law system nowadays.
Yeah, so what does he do? He kind of does the non-confrontational route.
Just kind of brushes it aside. Yeah.
He says, "All right, we'll put you under house arrest. I'll decide your case eventually." Spends 2 years going to him, and eventually, when he moves on, he leaves him in prison to appease the Jew. This is a complete conjecture. But I like to think that Drusilla was a nice person. Don't know why. I just... absolutely no textual basis for that. No reason to believe it.
I thought that.
At first,
Yeah. He just mentions her and the fact that she's Jewish.
Yeah.
Which might actually be evidence that she's not a nice person, because that might be part of why he doesn't actually rule on Paul's case and free him, because he wants to appease his wife also. Maybe she's siding with the Jews.
So a Roman married a Jew.
Yeah.
We're bridging the gap there.
Yeah.
So to put some things together for you, Hellenistic Jew, right? Any kids they have would be Hellenistic Jews, because it's a Roman, Felix, and a Jew. So they'd be growing up in the Roman customs and the Roman ways, but they'd be Jewish by birth.
They'd be half.
Yeah.
But since lineage through the woman, right? In this day and age? They're considered Jewish because she's Jewish? Although...
I was just saying they're Jewish just because, yeah, she's Jewish. But I'm talking ethnically speaking. But...
So to be raised as Romans, but considered Jewish people, Jews
exactly.
Of Jewish people.
Yeah. So that's.
So bridging the gap.
Yeah, that's why back in chapter 7 there's this dispute between the Hebraic Jews and the Hellenistic Jews. Hellenistic Jews are viewed as like the sellouts, the not real Jews, the half-breeds.
Mm.
Fake Jews.
But not as bad as those Samaritans.
Yeah.
Those are real sellouts.
Samaritans are, yeah.
We don't talk about that.
But if they keep marrying Roman people, then eventually will they still be considered Jews?
In the same way, I'm still considered Italian, but I'm only a quarter Italian. Yeah.
Irish, I think, like 1/16 or something. He sounds like a lot of judges these days.
I know, that's what I was saying.
I'll discuss this later, and then it's, then it's like 6 months, and you're like, where are we? And like, we'll deal with it later.
Just give it a minute. When I have time.
So it's during this time that Paul's probably writing a few of the books of the New Testament while he's under house arrest in Caesarea. And he spends 2 years chained up there. And now we have a new guy, Festus. So Porcius Festus is the next layer of Roman bureaucracy that Paul has to work through. So next week we'll probably go chapter 25 and 26. And then the week after that we will finish it up.